Welcome to the 2017 Bay Area Book Festival. This is Sherilyn Parsons, founder and director of the festival. Enjoy the conversation.
Good morning. So our three authors this morning, Jonas Lusher, Paul Murray, and Dori Schaffru, come from Germany by way of Switzerland, from Ireland, and from Los Angeles. In this session, we're going to be referring to the most recent novels that they've written, Barbarian Spring by Jonas, The Mark and the Void by Paul, and Startup by Dori. Now, taken together, these three books tell the economic story of the last decade, the excesses that led to the tech and housing boom, the crash, the uneven recovery in Europe, the current tech-fueled boom. And make no mistake about it, these books are funny. So buy them and read them, okay? Now, to get us started, I'm going to ask our three authors to introduce themselves, starting way on my left with Jonas.
Yeah, well, I'm Jonas, and I'm here with my first book, Barbarian Spring, which is a novella, which is translated into English. I have just recently published my second book, which is called Craft, which is a book about the relationship between old Europe thinking and Silicon Valley optimism, which will be published in English, I think, around Christmas or something like this. I'm born and raised in Switzerland, but I do live in Germany since 16 years. I have studied philosophy, and I have spent 4 years ago, almost a year here in the Bay Area, where I was a visiting researcher at Stanford University, so I know the Silicon Valley scene from this time.
Great, thank you. Paul?
Hello, good morning. My name is Paul. I'm from Dublin in Ireland. Can you hear me? I live in Dublin. Not sure what to tell you. I feel pretty jet lagged. You guys are also swimming around in front of me. I've written three books. This is my third book, The Mark and the Void. It was written as a kind of a response to the sort of economic disintegration. Well, partly in response to the economic disintegration of Ireland during the crash, but also about Ireland's sort of reinvention of itself in the 90s as a tax haven, which is not what you think of when you think of Ireland, and that's exactly what makes it such a good tax haven, and it may be very angry. So I put that anger into a book. And recently I've been writing a screenplay, which I thought would be easier than writing a book. It's not. But it's finished. I'm happy about that.
Thank you.
I'm very happy to be here. Thank you.
Dori?
Hi, I'm Dori. I do live in Los Angeles, but I grew up in Boston, and I lived in New York for almost 10 years, which is where my book is set. It's set in the New York tech scene, and it concerns a startup founder who has to raise a few million dollars for his startup before it goes bankrupt. And then he also happens to get caught up in a sexual harassment scandal, so things sort of go downhill for him from there. I also work at BuzzFeed. I'm a reporter for the tech desk. And I'm also very happy to be here. Thank you for coming.
Okay, thank you. So, a question for all of you to start. I know that humor is the most difficult kind of prose to write. I'm sure somebody said that once, although I don't know who that might be. So I'm not going to ask you where you get your ideas. I know that for most writers, that's the most annoying question readers ever ask us. But I am wondering how you get started writing a funny novel. What comes first? Is it a single scene? A character, a story you're dying to tell? What is it? Anyone? Who wants to talk first?
I can talk first. For me, it was the setting was inherently so funny to me. There's just so much absurdity in tech, especially right now, that I feel like I didn't even really need to do that much to make it funny. And I didn't set out to write a funny novel. I would, in fact, characterize my novel less as like hysterically funny and more sort of wry. It's not like set up joke kind of funny. And then by kind of starting with this culture that I thought was sort of ripe for a send up, I found it pretty easy to sort of navigate that. But it was also tricky because, you know, I wanted to address some pretty serious issues like sexual harassment, which are not exactly hilarious. So I felt like I was kind of threading this very thin needle sometimes to discuss these themes in a way that felt respectful, I guess.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah, it's very hard to talk about comic writing and why things are funny. I was talking, there was an author gala last night at which the authors were given free drinks for a dangerous amount of time. May have something to do with my jet lag, but I was talking to a couple of other writers and I was saying, oh, what are you doing tomorrow? What's your event about? And one guy said, mine's about fiction and trauma. The other guy said, mine's about the elusiveness of truth. And I said, oh, mine's about like why things are funny. And they're like, whoa, man, what are you going to do? Like, that sounds nice. So with that caveat, I think that personally, I think if you sort of sat down and said, like, I'm going to write a really funny book, you would write like a deeply unfunny book. Mm-hmm. It's really sort of, for me, just a temperamental thing. I guess it's just sort of the way I see the world. Mm-hmm. I suppose, coming from Ireland, there's quite a strong tradition of writing that's kind of simultaneously quite sort of funny and weird and also quite dark. And I find that using humor enables me to write about, just as Dory was saying, to write about some of the darker things. Like Ireland is like a really sort of pitch black history. But if you wrote about that sort of straight, so to speak, I think it would be less effective in a way. I think the humor, sort of the kind of the lights of the humor, actually make the darkness more vivid. And I guess that's why I like to write in that way. There's a great play by Samuel Beckett called Waiting for Godot, which many of you will be familiar with. And he does that. It's like, I think, the perfect sort of rendering of that mixture of humor and darkness. It's about these two tramps on the side of the road having a long conversation about how meaningless life is. And at one point they decide they're going to kill themselves, and they say, well, how are we going to do it? And one guy says, well, I've got a belt. We can hang ourselves with this belt. And Estragon says, okay, we'll take off your belt. Well, there's like a tree. We'll hang ourselves in this tree. And Estragon, indeed, he takes off his belt and his pants fall down, you know. And for me, that captures something like very, very true about life, like that even when life is at its darkest, there's nothing sort of solemn or ennobling about that darkness. Like life is going to remain cruel and laugh at you even when you feel like you deserve something a bit more of a break.
Thank you. Jonas?
Yeah, I would say too, it's about a certain view on life as itself. When I write kind of like from the perspective of a scientist who watches some insects with a magnifying glass or something like this. And I like to create something like a petri dish and put in people from a certain milieu and then from another milieu, and I watch what happens if they crash together. And I have to say, most of the time, it's quite funny to watch those insects. And yeah.
Yes, I can see that. Well, thank you all. I'm going to ask each of you individually a question or two, but I want you folks to start talking among yourselves. I mean, you hear something that somebody says that you think is outrageous, just why don't you point it out and get it into an argument, okay? Something like that. Whatever you feel like, okay? So I'll start with Jonas. You have a very impressive background in teaching. You've studied ethics and science. You mentioned philosophy that you've studied, comparative literature, as well as writing and editing. So you've studied in Switzerland, Germany, and the United States. You've even written a libretto for an opera. Yet your novel, Barbarian Spring, is set in Tunisia, and it's about a financial crisis that's like the Great Recession on steroids. Where did all that come from?
Well, that's the hard question. I was thinking a lot about economic topics in my philosophical work, and I worked about certain narrative approaches to complex social problems in philosophy. And so I mostly worked on examples from the financial world, so I felt strongly about writing fiction about these topics, because it's something... It's the whole economics world is so important for our lives. It's the background we live in front of. So there isn't enough literature about, I have the feeling. And the problem is that many writers tend to think that first it is boring, which it's definitely not. And second, many writers think they don't know enough about economic theory and stuff like this.
Yes.
And there I probably had like an advantage because I worked it on a scientific level. Well, I'm not an economist, but I worked on it in philosophy. Mm. And that was my starting point.
Hmm. Interesting. Okay. So, Dory, I know a hugely successful science fiction writer who's the author of more than 600 books. He started writing for money in college. He had a desk and a typewriter in a shared office near the campus. And every day he would show up, 5 days a week, weekends off, sit down at his typewriter at 9 a.m., write steadily at about 100 words per minute until noon, close up his typewriter, break for lunch, and the next day he'd be back at 9 and then go through the same process all over again. I guess he didn't have any morning classes. Is that the way you work, too?
I don't use a typewriter. And I'm much less prolific. I have not written nearly as many books as he has.
Yeah, I think one is less than 600.
Yeah. The one similarity I can point to with that gentleman is I am at my most productive in the morning. So when I started writing my book, I've been working full time at BuzzFeed, and at the time I was editing and managing a team of people, and I wasn't writing very much, and I decided that I needed my own kind of creative project, and if it never saw the light of day, then whatever, it would be fine. So I decided I was going to write every day for the month of January 2015. And I got up every morning and went into my office and wrote on a computer. But I did turn off the internet, so it was sort of like a typewriter.
Oh.
And I did that, and then at the end of the month, I had 60 pages. So, you know, I think there is something to the consistency, even if, you know, I didn't write for 2 hours. I wrote for like half an hour to an hour every day, but I think there's something to that. So I respect that method very much.
How about the others? Are you that disciplined about your writing, or does it just come and go?
I think that you really have to be disciplined with it. Like the way that writing certainly works for me, it's a bit like a relationship. It's a bit like sort of at the beginning you'll have an idea and it's very exciting, it's very captivating, and you'll have this quite sort of, you know, I think when people who don't write think about the writing life, they imagine this first phase as being kind of typical of it, which is, you know, you're kind of in the grip of the muse and you're writing and you're weeping and you're sweating and you're in a vest and you're in Paris and so forth. And that's all great, but then after a while you'll realize that there's a famous description of the novel by Randall Jarrell as he called the novel an extended piece of prose with something wrong with it. And after a while, you'll go like, oh, just as in a relationship, you go like, oh, wait a second. This isn't quite as straightforward as I thought it was going to be. There'll be some kind of a flaw, there'll be some kind of a difficulty, and it becomes much more laborious, and you'll have days where you go and sit at your desk and just nothing will happen. And I think, like, if you don't have the regular routine, then at that point it's really tempting to go, like, well, I'm just going to take a day off, or maybe I'll start something else. Like, that's the more kind of dangerous temptation, you know, like, maybe I'll write this little short story here, or I'll do this little thing for this. And if you did that, then you'd never finish anything. So I'm a firm believer in just, is it Woody Allen? Woody Allen line is like 80% of success is showing up. Like, if you're not at the bus stop, you can't get the bus. So just, you show up, even if it feels like you're not going to get anything down, just show up day after day after day after day, and then finally you'll manage to get through these whatever kind of issues the book has.
Yeah, I think another platitude along those same lines that I like is done is better than perfect. You know, if you're just so worried about perfection all the time, then you're never going to finish anything. But yes, you really just described my whole process. So, yeah.
Jonas?
No, it's kind of different. I don't have a lot of discipline, or not all the days the same schedule. Most days it takes me like an hour or two to get enough courage to read what I have written the evening before, and then I am really very slow. So on really good days I write like 2,000 characters or something like this. But for me it's kind of the opposite of what you said, because I try to have it more or less perfect on a directly. I don't rewrite. I mean, it's not perfect, but I know writers who say it's like 80% or 20% of the time is writing and 80% is rewriting. But for me, it's kind of the opposite. I write really, really slowly, so it's often just one sentence a day. Well, some sentences in my book are like 2 pages or 3, so then it takes me more than one day for a sentence. But if I just do it and it's not really, I don't really like it, then on the next day it's too hard for me to read it. So it has to be already finished, each sentence. Yeah, so I rewrite each sentence, then I go to the next sentence. Things more like this. But it's just another strategy.
I think the hardest part of the job for me, and probably for a lot of writers, is just as Jonas is describing, like when you have to come back and look at what you've written, like even if it's the next day or if it's 3 months later, it's always just like horror, just a moment. Like,
yeah, I never immediately reread my stuff from the day before. Oh, no. How would I go on?
Yeah, that's exactly the point. Yeah.
Exactly. Okay, question for Paul. The Mark and the Void is your third novel. It was listed by Time as one of the top 10 best fiction books for 2015. Your second novel, Skippy Dies, made that list in 2010. And what does that recognition really mean for you? Does it help sell more books?
I don't know. I guess so. I mean, that's not really my department. That's the publicists will go, like, will be very pleased if it gets that kind of press.
So you're completely oblivious of it?
No, I'm not oblivious. But like, I really try, and without trying to sound kind of sententious, a jet lag word I've made up. I'm not, without trying to sound sententious, like I really feel like it's great, like it's fantastic to get an accolade like that is really, really like affirming, because you have so much doubt and you have so much like fear that what you're doing is like is not good enough, or if even if it is good enough, that like no one in the world is going to read it. There are so many books out there, so to get that kind of attention is like just like a tremendous gift, you know. Definitely. At the same time, I would have to keep, if I hadn't been in those lists, I would still try and show up every day at the desk, you know. Yeah. So I think you really need to kind of try and wall off your writing practice from what's happening in the outside world, you know, and not be too caught up in it.
Well, there's a broader question along those lines. It's about reviews. Jonas, do you? I mean, you get a lot of reviews for your books. Do you read them? Do you shun them? Do you get upset if you get a bad review?
Yeah, I read them. I don't believe any writer who says I don't read them. He's not reading them. But yeah, and the strange thing is that you can get like 20 good reviews and one bad one, and you tend to think a lot of the time about this one bad one. But at the end, it's the same. I would agree, you have to shove it away when you start writing, and it has to be... you shouldn't think too much about it. And it certainly shouldn't influence your writing. Or there are very few reviews, mostly the critical ones, where you can learn something, where you read it and you think, okay, that he might have a point, and you can think about that for your next book, but normally I would say don't think about all the numbers and the sales and all this stuff. Don't even think about the reader when you write.
Don't even think about the reader when you write.
Yeah, because then you start writing just to please somebody.
Oh.
I wouldn't.
I was always told to write for my great aunt.
Okay. If she has a good taste in literature, why not?
Okay. Well, so Dory, who do you write for?
I mean, I agree that you can't write for a reader or the reader, and there's no like monolith of readers.
Sure.
I guess I write for the reader who is me. Like, I write the book that I would want to read. So I guess I am writing for a reader, but the reader is myself.
Well, that's...
Perhaps that is, you know, my egomania, but...
No, that's not egomania. I think that's pretty well adjusted.
Thank you.
Because if you're fearful of what readers are going to say, then you'll never get a word on paper.
Yeah, I think that's true.
Yeah, right. Okay, well, another question for Jonas, then. Given your background in so many serious fields, I'm still wondering how you write humor. Does it come easily to you at all, or is it sweat and tears all the way? I mean, writing as slowly as you do, it seems to suggest that it is not an easy process for you.
No, it's not, and sometimes I'm surprised myself that it's kind of funny in the end, because when I'm doing it, it doesn't feel funny. But on the other way, it's often a dark humor, and it's very irony is kind of important for me, and to write in a very kind of a distant manner. I'm not really interested in writing very close to my characters or to find a close connection to my characters, or even that the reader is finding a close connection. It's more about the distance is more interesting for me than the yeah. And this irony is mostly for me one instrument to find this kind of distance to the character. So it's more like it's a tool.
Thank you. Paul, you may have answered this already, but I want to zero in a little bit more on it. I'm wondering, what comes first? Is it the story or the humor? Are you laughing when you set out to write a comic novel?
I mean, that's a sort of a... perhaps not a flattering image of oneself as a writer, kind of like just walking, kind of chuckling, chuckling to myself. But yeah, I mean, it's probably what does happen at the start. I think all of the books that I've written have started off with a line or a situation or a gag of some kind. Like I wrote a short story. I can't remember the line properly, but I mean, there's always some. That's usually what kind of kicks it off. So, for instance, this book, The Mark and the Void, it's about a banker who meets an author, and the joke of it is that the banker is this kind of quite poetic, sort of sensitive, gentle man, and the writer is like this very kind of money-driven, cynical, like amoral hack. So you start off with like just like a concept like that, and then like more jokes will sort of appear. And so the structure of the books, often at the start anyway, like I'll think of a joke, and then I'll think of another joke, and how can I get from that joke to that joke? And that's where the story sort of appears. But it's quite a mysterious process, because like if you try and think of a joke, as I said earlier, it tends not to work. I mean, you hear these stories about like TV writers who all sit around a big table and they're there for like 9 hours or 10 hours until they finish an episode. And I have no idea how you could create comedy in that kind of situation. So for me, it's kind of quite natural. Like the jokes are kind of the bits that come naturally, and then sort of the infrastructure of the novel is the hard part. Like getting like connecting those dots is the hard part.
Uh-huh. Dory, how do you start a novel?
Well, this is my first novel, so I can speak to how I started this novel.
Oh, that's a good start.
I started with some characters and a world, and like I said in the beginning, I didn't really think that this was going to go anywhere, so that kind of gave me permission to just sort of write whatever I wanted. And what I turned out to want to write was just kind of creating some characters and a situation, but I didn't really have a whole story in mind. I certainly didn't have a whole novel in mind. And in fact, one of the characters who I started with, I ended up writing an entire... My book is told from the perspective of three different characters, and I wrote an entire draft of the book with one of these characters, and then I was like, no. And I got rid of his whole perspective, and now he's in like three pages of the book. So that was sort of how I started. I started with this guy who is not the guy I mentioned before, but a different guy whose company has just failed, and he's this sort of sad sack. Sort of funny, but it wasn't that funny. But I think I needed to sort of write through all of these different characters to figure out what the story was and what the world was. And since I'd never written a novel before, I didn't have like a process that I went through. So it was a little bit making it up as I went along. Jonas, what you said about the 80-20 writing versus rewriting. I rewrote the first 100 pages of my book about 20 times. Mm-hmm. That's just how I did it. I didn't really start with a joke, but I like that.
Well, obviously the lead needs to grab the reader in some way or another. What do you do about that, Jonas?
About your lead
lead for the book.
Well, it's for me, it's mostly not really an idea. It's mostly a character, but then it's more like a feeling I have, which kind of sound I want to have for this text. And what I then try while writing is to keep this feeling alive. And feeling is actually really the better word than idea, because an idea is would be too precise. It's often about the sound and the rhythm, and more about the general emotion I want to have in the book. And that's kind of the hardest part in writing, is to keep this feeling alive and not to lose it.
Okay. Back to Dory.
Okay.
Your novel, your first novel, Startup, is oddly enough about a startup.
Indeed.
It's a New York-based tech company that started by an entrepreneur with a $600 million idea. Now, get this. It's a way to improve a mindfulness app. So the world...
Well, it is a mindfulness app.
Yes, that's a very good question to start with. The world of high tech and venture capital is known to be very difficult to enter, especially for women. Mm-hmm. And that's, in a way, what your novel is about. I know you report on tech for BuzzFeed. So is that how you became familiar with the ways and means of the tech world?
Sort of. I actually just switched to this beat about a few weeks ago. So I wasn't writing about tech when I started writing the novel. But I had, when I lived in New York, I'd written about the New York tech world and always just found it very amusing. And I found the characters to be like very amusing. And I never lived in San Francisco or Silicon Valley, so I didn't have firsthand knowledge of what that world was like. But to me, the tech scene in New York seemed to be kind of uniquely New York flavored, and I was always intrigued by that. And then when I started at BuzzFeed, it was 65 people and felt very much like a startup and considered itself a tech startup. So I sort of had firsthand knowledge of that. I feel like, just to go back to something that you were asking about earlier, there's so much that's just sort of inherently so ridiculous in this world that, in fact, I felt like at times I had to kind of dial it back because it didn't... I felt like if I tried to make it funny, quote unquote, then it was just going to feel like a caricature. And I didn't want it to feel that way. And something that's been interesting is that my book keeps getting referred to as a satire. And I did not intend for it to be a satire. Certainly did not sit down and say, I'm going to write a satire now. So I just think it's interesting. I don't have any like particularly deep thoughts or, I don't know why it has been called a satire, but that is the label that people have been putting on it. So.
Well, they've got to have some label to put on it, right?
Yeah, I guess that's it.
Right. You know, I'm curious, how many of you have actually studied creative writing before you started to write? Gone to a writer's workshop or taken a course or more in university?
Yeah, I did that. Yeah.
You did?
Yeah.
Was that helpful?
It got my parents off my back. It's weird. Like, I mean, if you're like everyone in Ireland is writing a novel, you know. So if you tell someone, if I graduated college, and you know, if someone says, well, what are you doing with your life now? And you say you're writing a novel, it's like saying, well, I'm smoking a lot of weed and I'm in a basement and I've got some really interesting ideas about like time, you know. If you say you're doing a master's. It gives it a sort of an air of respectability to the whole adventure. And in East Anglia is this famous. It's kind of like the IO workshop of the United Kingdom, and it was so it's like it's extra prestigious because you know you go to England and you know they, obviously everything's more proper in England. So I did that and it was great. Like it was I had a friend. I used to work in a bookshop, which is a good sort of apprenticeship of its own nature for writers because you realize like how hard it is to get people to buy a book, you know. But I had a friend who had just been on this workshop a few years before, and he suggested that I give it a try. So I did that, and my first book got published as a result because my tutor Ali Smith was a Scottish writer. Told her editor about the book that I was working on, and I'd come home. It was after I'd come home, and I was back with my parents, and I was in like even more debt than previously, and my dad was giving me a ride to the train station one night, and he goes like, and I should say my dad is a professor of literature, but my dad said, you know, son, you've given this your best shot in invisible square brackets and quite a lot of our financial resources. So it's time to, you know, it's just time to, maybe it's just time to give it up and get a proper job. And that very night I got an email from the editor saying, you know, we want to publish your book. So it was like one of those great It was a great moment.
You mentioned Alex Smith. Is that Alexander McCall Smith?
No, it's Ali Smith.
Oh, Ali Smith. Yeah. Okay.
Warmly recommended.
All right. So, Jonas?
No, I didn't took any classes in creative writing, which also has to do with that creative writing classes are relatively new in Germany. I would say it's something which came up like the last 10 to 15 years, but that's, I'm telling the same thing like the last discussion. I hope not too many people are here again. it's relatively new.
Yes.
I took a couple of creative writing classes as an undergraduate, but I don't have an MFA.
Well, I was just wondering, were those classes helpful? Did you learn anything?
Yeah, I mean, one was a creative nonfiction class, and then one was a fiction class. Yes. I mean, I don't know, it was a long time ago. The fiction writing class was short stories. I did take a screenwriting class once I moved to L.A., because, like, that seemed like the thing you should do once you move to L.A., take a screenwriting class. And the class itself was, like, not very good, but it did make me think about story structure in a way that I had not previously thought about it. And once you kind of learn the way that every screenplay is written, you watch movies and you know exactly what's going to happen, because every movie, it turns out, is exactly the same. So that was interesting. but actually did help me with my novel in terms of plot, which is very hard, especially when you've been a journalist and you're used to, you know, writing a story, but you're not making up the story. So I had to learn how to make up the story and then also to write the story.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there is a big difference between writing fiction and nonfiction.
Yes, there is. I mean, it sounds very obvious, and, like, it is very obvious, but you know, I think I had the experience that Paul was describing of the initial euphoria of starting writing, and also, you know, this new experience of writing fiction and feeling like, ha ha ha, like, I'm the puppet master, I control the fates of these characters. And then a few months in, being like, oh shit, I control the fates of these characters. So, yeah.
Okay. Well, let's take a change of pace here for a bit. I'm address this to Jonas and Paul. You've both written what people have, at any rate, have called satirical novels about the financial crisis. And I know that you, Paul, have lived through one of the most extreme versions of that crisis in Ireland, which was especially hard hit. Now, clearly, you both understand the financial dynamics that led to the crisis. The dark picture that you've painted suggests you're afraid that things are going to go bad again. Is it true? Are you worried?
Well, there was a regrettable... Ireland had a very strange... when I was growing up, Ireland was sort of a very... quite a, like a poor agricultural backwater, and it was a place that people left if you had ambition or ideas. You'd go to England, or you'd come to the United States, or you'd go to Germany or France, wherever it might be. But you just left because there was nothing happening in Ireland. And then over a period of, like, a really short period of time, in the late 90s till about 2006, it was transformed, like, almost, you know, it was like money was raining down from the skies. All of these big IT firms and big pharma firms set up in Ireland. And so it was the first time you could get a really good job. You could come out of college and get a really good job. And that was great for a while. And then it all started to kind of slide into craziness. People were taking a lot of drugs and drinking an awful lot. And there was an air of, which I think is something that recurs throughout history, this sort of air of that we've somehow hit some new way of doing things whereby we've worked it out, and, like, nothing bad will ever happen again. We're just going to keep on making money, and the thing's just going to get better and better and better. We're going to get richer and richer and richer and richer forever, in defiance of all economic laws. And that was the philosophy. So when the crash came, People have been warning about a crash for a long time, like for years before, but everybody believed that this Celtic Tiger, as it was regrettably known as what the economy was called, this Celtic Tiger like just was unkillable. And then when the crash came, it was the biggest destruction of wealth of any nation in peacetime in history. Like it was like just a colossal just like devastation of the country. And now the whole thing's slowly cranking up again, and they're calling it the Celtic Phoenix. And you know, you're suddenly seeing all of these Nespresso shops opening everywhere. Like all these like vacant lots are suddenly everyone's going like, I really need like another Nespresso machine. It's really frightening. It's just really like it's. I mean, there's like sort of a bit at the end of my book where like the two characters are going, you know. Well, I guess like in 5 years' time, we'll just wait for like the whole thing to start happening again. But at the same time, I didn't think it would actually start happening again so quickly. But you know, it's like history teaches us that history teaches us nothing. There's this magical thinking. Like everybody's just convinced that well, this time like what's oh, I forget that someone said that. The four most dangerous words in the English language are "this time will be different." That's five words. Sorry, the five most dangerous words are "this time will be different."
Yeah. Oh yes, this yeah. time will be different.
But that's the philosophy that guides yeah. much of the 21st century.
Yeah. Well, Germany wasn't quite as badly hit. Certainly not as badly hit as Ireland, but
yeah.
it was bad.
That's right. It was. By far not that bad, but I think if you live in Europe, you have to see the broader European perspective, and you have to take in account what happens in France and in Greece and in Spain and even, of course, also in Ireland. So when I started writing Barbarian Spring, that was, I think, in 2011, and it was strongly under the influence of what we just kind of survived in 2008, 2009. But then my fear was that it will happen again, and the book is about an imaginary future financial crisis resulting from the one from 2008, because I had the feeling that we didn't really change things, not substantially enough. And right now, today, I would say my fear is even bigger, because what we experience in Great Britain now after the Brexit is that they will have a lot of problems with their economy, so they have to rely on the financial industry even more. So they don't want to regulate anything. And in the States here, I mean, you know that the new administration already, I think, ended the Dobbs-Frank Act or tried to end it and things like this. So I'm afraid, yeah, the next crisis will come pretty soon, probably.
It's not mysterious. It's like if the foxes were running the hen house, you know, and like with the Trump administration, you've got a bunch of people from Goldman Sachs, you know, it's like foxes, will you behave yourselves this time? Mm-hmm. And the foxes are like, well, we might not. Okay, that's good enough. Let's just give this a shot.
Okay. So Dory, how about you? You obviously your book, as well as the others, were written before Donald Trump really came onto the scene. In Startup, you come across as pretty unenthusiastic about the tech industry. By extension, not very optimistic about the future, I would guess. Are you worried? Do you think things are going to go from bad to worse?
Well, I am not... I feel like I don't view the tech scene with rose-colored glasses, but nor am I a pessimist. I mean, if you read The Circle by Dave Eggers, for example, he has an extremely pessimistic view of tech, and I am not quite there. You know, I work for a tech company, and I write about tech. I think there's a lot that is, to use an overly used word, that's problematic about tech, but I do think that on the whole, a lot of tech has improved our lives and hopefully connected people to each other in a way that wasn't possible before. Now, that being said, I think that we did not learn the lessons from the first internet bubble, certainly. And you see a lot of the same things happening again. And I think that the overvaluation of tech companies and the money that gets thrown around is really troubling. And, you know, I agree with Paul. I mean, I studied history as an undergraduate. Like, history repeats itself. That has been proven time and time again since literally the beginning of time. So to think that another crash is not coming, I think, is kind of being willfully naive.
Yeah, you mentioned the overvaluation of tech companies. I think 4 out of the 5 most valuable companies in the world, by way of market cap, are tech companies, American tech companies. It's shocking. It's shocking. I mean, Apple is approaching $1 trillion.
At least Apple makes things.
Well, that's true. I mean, that's true. Yes, that's right. All right. So, what else do you want to talk about? You're writers. You always have things on your mind. What comes to mind is.
Well, I'm curious, as an American, to what extent do you guys get government support from Ireland and Germany?
Oh, that's an interesting question.
Climbs onto high horse. I was talking to a guy, a composer, just last week, and he was talking. He told me that Ireland has the lowest spend on arts of any country in Europe except Moldova. So there's a weird paradox whereby, like, Ireland is. Rosemary's giving me a look here. That may not be true, but Ireland is a country that there is, like, it really milks the arts for all it can, like, in terms of marketing the country abroad. But certainly the current government has a deep, I was going to say deep loathing for the arts, that's facetious, but they really don't think the arts are of interest or of use, except for this kind of, like, advertising function. So, I mean, that's not to say that things aren't better than they are in the United States, because I don't know, I know the National Endowment for the Arts is under siege. I don't know how generous that endowment is or isn't anyway, but in Ireland you can, like when I was writing my first book, you could get a bursary from the Arts Council that would give you I think it was €12,000, and you could live on that for, like, maybe like 8 months if you're frugal. So, like, that's 8 months of time. Like, it's not loads, but it's not nothing either. But I think that there's so much more could be done. You know, if they weren't so busy, like, bailing out, like, banks. I mean, the big story in Ireland at the moment is that, like, sort of the kingpin of this, like, banking catastrophe that happened has just been completely exonerated from everything that he did. And meanwhile, like, everybody's paying this, like, this huge tax hike to pay for the ruin the banks brought about. And that's not even part of the national conversation. So I really wish that the government and also the people of Ireland were, like, just a little bit more considered about what they wanted from a society. So it climbs down from high horses.
Jonas?
I would say we're in a quite happy situation in Switzerland, also in Germany, I would say. There is a lot of governmental funding on different levels. There are a lot of, like, prizes you can get, which are quite highly, quite a lot of money to win. Mm-hmm. But there is also a lot of support in translations. Like, many of my translations are financed or supported by the government, by the what's called the Prolefetia or the Goethe Institute in Germany. Well, I have the really good situation that the Germans read me as a German writer and the Swiss as a Swiss writer. So I, it's really comfortable. And what's really a nice thing is that they send you around a lot with the books, with the translations. So I have like long reading tours in Russia and in the Arab world and stuff like this. That's really something I appreciate. And what we have in the German world are these paid reading tours, which are mostly also, or many of them are also financed by the government in the way. Yeah, we go for readings in libraries, in what we call a literature house. Most cities have a literature house. It's just like a theater, just for theater readings. So you go there, you read like an hour, which is a horrible idea for most other people. And it's just, we call it a water glass reading. It's just a writer and a glass of water, and he reads like an hour, and then a short discussion. And we have that a lot, and it's paid. We get quite well paid, and it's something most or many German and Swiss and Austrian writers live from. Like I have this year, I have almost 80 readings. So you don't write in this year, but you earn your money in this year, and then you have another 4 or 5 years to write. So,
oh, wow. Yeah.
That's quite convenient, yes.
Yeah, don't we wish we had that here? Yeah.
So what's the story here? Like, is there any funding for like new writers or?
Are you kidding?
No.
We're the age of we're the country of capitalism. Mm. Yeah, the market will tell the difference between good and bad. Yes, right?
Yes.
Yes. Well, okay. But before we open this up to questions from you folks, I want to just ask each of you, what are you working on now? What do we have to look forward to in the more or less near future?
I'm working on a stage play for the theater in Zurich. It's a commission. Do you call it a commission? Yeah, a commission. Yes.
So we don't have that to look forward to unless we speak German and can get to Switzerland.
I'm afraid, yeah.
Yeah, okay. All right. Paul?
I just finished writing this screenplay, and it's going to shoot in July, so I'm really excited about that. Yeah, like a really tiny little sort of indie film, but it's the first film I've ever been part of, so I'm really excited about that, I have to say. Yeah.
It's not based on any of your books.
No, it's like a whole new thing. Yeah.
Great.
I
am coming up with some ideas for another novel.
Okay. You know, just another question just occurred to me. It's probably just for Jonas and Paul. A Norwegian writer told me yesterday that of all the income he receives, practically all of it comes from domestic sales. And his books have been translated into many languages, sold in English and German and whatever. And yet he doesn't even know how much money he makes from the translated editions. But he knows it's not very much. Do you have anything like a similar experience?
No. Well, like domestic Ireland's really small, so you wouldn't make enough selling books
just
in Ireland.
Well, so is Norway.
Yeah, right. Yeah, yes. Well, who is this guy? I mean, I hit him for $10. Germany is great. Like I Germans are famously big readers, and so I've been on a few, not as many as Jonas, but like when you go to Germany and you tour around, people will come to the readings. They will read translated fiction, which broadly speaking in the English speaking world, people don't. And they buy your books. Like, you know, if your book is translated into German or French or Italian, whatever it might be, you know, you get paid, and it's great. So I don't know. This guy must be making so much money that like it sounds like he just gives it to his accountant.
He says that in Norway, with a population of 5 million, that a really top best-selling author like Jo Nesbø will sell 200,000 copies.
Right.
And get paid $8 a copy.
$8 a copy?
Yeah. Yep.
That's nice.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, I could use that.
You don't get $8 a copy.
You get like 7% of the cover price.
How much?
Yeah.
7%?
Yeah.
No. That's actually low for here.
Is it?
Yes.
Okay, yeah.
Yeah, it is. How about you, Jonas?
Yeah, I get about 10 to 14% of the retail price. But I do also most of my money in the German-speaking world. And maybe I earned a little bit of money in France because there it was quite well sold. But I have a lot of translations in really small markets like Belarus and stuff like this. And then I see when they make the contract with Belarus, it's about the advance, and they're discussing about paying 200 or 300 euros advance. That's about what you get. So it's really, or like Albania and stuff like this. It's nice to have the translation, but you don't do it for the money.
Well, I've been on book tours, and I've never been paid a nickel by anybody to promote my book. Mm-hmm. You're saying that you can do that? You can go do a reading and promote your book, and you get...
Yeah, I would never do a reading without getting paid for, actually, in Germany. You don't do that.
Good
no,
grief. I'm moving to Germany, or maybe Norway. Mm-hmm. Yeah, okay. All right, well, anybody have any last words before we turn to questions from the audience? So we do have questions there. I know we do. Okay, there was somebody way in the back on the... Yes, now stand up and be very...
Oh, there's a mic.
Oh, there is a mic.
Oh, God.
Oh,
all right.
Well, wonderful.
All right. My question is actually, how does one, if they have a book that's published in English in this country, go about switching it or finding someone to translate and then market it in another country?
Thanks for your question. I think that's your agent will sell your book. That's not something that you really have any control over.
Right.
A very nice lady wrote to me a few years ago and said, I've translated your book into French. Do you know anywhere where I could sell this translation? And I spoke to the agent, and the agent said, like, the publishing houses, the French publishing houses, will have their own translator, and they won't take on unsolicited translations.
Right. Yeah.
So it's not something that it's not something that you, as the author, have any power over at all, I don't think.
Let's say a German publisher. I mean,
you don't.
You don't. Your agent will. There are these big book fairs, for instance, in Frankfurt or London or New York, where publishers from all over the world will come and books are like sold like commodities. The rights to the books to publish the book in Germany or France, wherever it might be. But you personally will not have any say in whether or not that happens. I'm sorry.
It'll be your publisher or your agent.
I don't know.
That would be difficult.
Hi. It occurs, a question for Paul and Jonas. It occurs that both of you are from countries that have been divided and then reunified. And has that experience entered into your approach to humor at all?
Do you want to?
Yeah, please.
yeah, well, I guess... like, Ireland's split is, like, obviously there was the Troubles, but they're just kind of like the more recent manifestation of, like, a much longer historical issue, I guess, which is that, like, the country has basically gone through, like, a series of colonizations, like the Vikings and then the Normans and then the British. So you're coming from a country and a history which has never really belonged to the people who live there. Until very, very recently. And I guess that would give you sort of a skewed idea of how the world works, or kind of like a cynical idea of how the world works. Like, I mean, if you're from a colonized country, the stuff, like, nothing around you belongs to you, you know? So all of the words mean one thing to the master and another thing to the servant, you know? Like, so I guess that's possibly part of the reason that Irish writers have this kind of strangely... Well, humor is one of the ways that manifests, that like that language has this kind of double meaning. It's got the official meaning, which comes from like London or wherever it might be, or Rome, where the priests are all dictating. And then it's got the secret meaning, the kind of the coded meaning that you kind of you have amongst yourselves.
It probably didn't really had such a great impact on me because, first of all, I grew up in Switzerland, which is a country which is basically for 700 years the same, or at least that's what they tend to say. And I was kind of too young to really experience the things in Germany. I was like 13 years old when the wall came down, and so it's not really my story.
I think in Ireland, like you do, there is sort of a tradition of kind of, you know, there's people had very hard lives for a very long time, and like humor is one of the ways that you deal with that, you know. So that would be a big influence there too.
Okay.
I'm just curious for Paul and Jonas. You've both written successful novels, and then Paul, you've written a screenplay, and Jonas, you're working on a stage play. Mm-hmm. Had you studied, like, that's the different genre? Had you studied how to do screenplay writing and playwriting as opposed to fiction, or was any, you know, how was it making that transition?
I found it very, very difficult. I like writing dialogue, so I thought like a film was just a whole load of dialogue. When I proudly handed in my sort of, you know, 300-minute sort of kind of comedy about just people yammering back and forth, I was sort of taken aside, and it was a real learning process. A film is much more structured, and I was really interested in what you said, like that all films are the same. Like that's it's true. Like once you kind of learn the way that they're put together. I was watching Manchester by the Sea, for instance, which is a terrific film, but it hits all of the beats, yeah. You know. So I was interested in like how you did your screenwriting training kind of help you or hinder you when you came to write your book.
It helped me. I'd written a whole draft of the book without really thinking about what I'd learned in the screenplay class, and then realized that the book was not very interesting, and went back and kind of examined the beats of a screenplay and thought, well, if I try to kind of impose those on my book, will that help, especially in terms of like moving the plot along? And I found it helped a lot. At first it can seem very formulaic, but there's also something that's very, to me, there's something very interesting creatively about having these constraints put on you, and then what can you do kind of within those constraints. So I found screenplay structure to be very helpful.
I think like a lot of writers find plot like very difficult, and the screenwriting seemed to me like a real kind of like not a masterclass, more like a boot camp in,
exactly.
in like pure plot. It's
yes.
all plot.
It's all plot.
So, yeah.
Thank you. This is really brilliant. Jonas. So Germany is a very market-driven, financially driven country. I mean, you know, so what rationale does the government give for supporting the arts the way they do? Okay, that's number one. Secondly, I'm interested in your characterization of your distance and your closeness to the character, that you remain distant, and you even expect, expect the reader to remain distant. What do you mean by that? Could you give an example of distance and closeness, and why is that important for you? Those two questions.
The first question is, I would say that for most European countries, it is one of the genuine, genuine tasks of every government to support the culture, all kinds of culture. Because I think we tend to say cultural things are just so substantial for every democracy. You can't run a democracy without books and pictures and movies and arts. It's just substantial for the education of people living in a democracy. So it's something the state has to do, which is, I think, quite different from here. But I mean, we're fighting about that too. There are also like right-wing populists and conservatives who think we should get rid of it because most of the arts are liberal and left-wing stuff, so they would like to get rid of all of it. So it's not just the happy. It's not all happy about that. But and the other question, well, that's kind of difficult to explain, but I would say there are writers who try to get into, to write themselves into the life and to go into the, into where it's, where all the darkness is, and try to also get the reader in there and try to get a real close bonding to between the characters and the reader. And for me, it's more like I feel like a hunter sitting on a, I don't know the English word, to, you know, the high stand where you stand as a, yeah, as a hunter, and you watch into the woods, but you don't go there yourself. It's a distant view on the world, and it's for me, it's a strategy to write the world away from me, and not to, yeah, it's, and that's the way I cope with what happens today.
Another question over here.
Yeah, for any or all of the panel, I was wondering what authors or books you think are funny or insightful about tech or finance or economic bubbles in general.
Capital by John Lanchester, I think is how you say his name, is, I think, a really great and smart and occasionally funny book about the financial crisis of 2008. It takes place in London.
Capital.
Michael Lewis is amazing, obviously. He's a, yeah. There's a book called Super Sad True Love Story by Gary Steingart, which is more about sort of like a kind of dystopian future, but there's a lot of extremely funny stuff about, like, where he takes tech just slightly further down the road, and it's fantastic.
It's hilarious.
Yeah.
It's called
Super Sad True Love Story by Gary Steingart. Warmly recommended.
Yeah, those are the two I would have also had in mind.
Yeah,
pretty much.
Yeah. Good question.
Okay.
I was raised in New York and I live in California. I'd like to ask Dory what she meant when she said that the startup scene in New York has a, quote, uniquely New York flavor.
Well, so I think in San Francisco and in Silicon Valley, it, at least from my perspective, and again, this is as someone who has not lived here, but it seems, especially in Silicon Valley, to have really taken over those cities and towns. And everywhere you go, everything is about tech. Whereas in New York, tech is a part of the city's ecosystem, but there's still these, you know, powerful legacy industries like media, finance, fashion, that still hold a lot of power and influence in the city, and tech is sort of figuring out how to navigate among those industries. So I think that the city itself has a lot of influence on the direction that a lot of the tech companies in New York have taken.
As a follow-up, are the personalities distinctly different?
I mean, yes and no. I think that there is a certain flavor of tech company founder that is a cliche for a reason, because that type of person tends to exist in different places. But, you know, I think also engineers have much more cultural or social capital in Silicon Valley and in San Francisco than they do in New York. So I think that's a little bit different, just to give a couple of examples.
Yeah.
We have time for one more question.
Really?
That's fine. Okay. For Paul, you're an Irish writer, and what do you think about works of George Bernard Shaw, has ever been any inspiration for you? Because he's very famous Irish playwright and writer. So what do you think about his work?
George Bernard Shaw, yeah, I mean, I'm not an expert, I'm afraid, at all. He won the Nobel Prize. He was a great wit. Pygmalion was a famous play.
More than 100 different plays.
100 different? You know more than I do. Yes. Yeah. Yeah. That's you should be feeling that question for yourself.
This is the one last question, or actually it's a comment, because this is absurd and hilarious. Here's something absurd and hilarious that one of you can get your arms around, and that is if you go into an American bank to open a savings account, the amount of interest that you will get is hilarious. Because I always ask my banker, what are you paying today? And they always look at me like, get out of here. Because it's less than 0.5%.
Oh, yeah.
You can't save any money on that. So I guess Americans are saving money underneath their mattress. But that's something you can address.
Okay, well, thank you very much, all of you, for coming. And I want to thank in particular our very generous writers, Jonas, Paul, and Dori, for spending the time with us today and sharing your insight.
We hope you enjoyed this podcast from the 2017 Bay Area Book Festival. For more podcasts, please go to www.baybookfest.org.